You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hi, my name is Nicole Ouellette. I'm the Chief of Staff here at the Open Society Foundation, and I am standing in today for Patrick Gaspard, our president, who sends his regrets. He very, very much wanted to be here today. As soon as Emily Martinez and I talked to him about this event, he was immediately on board and very excited. And he is a far more eloquent speaker than I am. So please bear with me as I try and do him and this incredibly important work justice. But I'll give it my best. Patrick was pulled away unexpectedly and has sent me in his stead. And I will be sure to tell him all about this event. And again, welcome. We're so pleased that everyone came despite the winter snowstorm and state of emergency we seem to be having. So thank you for your dedication to being here. It is an honor to be here today with a group of advocates who have helped bring about true breakthrough in disability rights. As many of you know, in Peru at the end of 2018 and then in Colombia just a few months later, these two countries were the first to recognize the full legal capacity of all citizens. This is an enormous win for the disability rights movement, a movement which we at OSF are deeply committed to. Recognizing this right has been a key goal of the movement since the adoption of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in 2008. And we are pleased to be joined to talk about this today. Can you guys hear me okay? This mic is not as bendy as one might hope. Great. We're pleased to be joined by activists to speak about this groundbreaking legislation. I will try not to butcher names, but it is a special talent of mine, unfortunately. But Claudia Zapata, yes, great, a self-advocate from Colombia and a facilitator for supported decision-making. Corinne Lisa Gutierrez from the Peruvian Down Syndrome Society. Patricia Andrade, who heads the pilot work with the Peruvian Down Syndrome Society and is supporting Corinne today. And Pamela Smith, the executive director of SOTUS, an organization that was deeply involved in the adoption of this law in Peru. It is an honor to have you all here with us today. Thank you. We are excited to hear your stories and hear your insights, and we hope that in the years to come, this stage will be filled with far more self-advocates from many countries telling their stories about how this right is now protected all around the world. This is not a new issue for us at OSF. In 2011, our president emeritus, Aria Nair, wrote about Maria Alejandra Villanueva, a young woman with Down syndrome from Lima, Peru. At that time, the Peruvian government had taken a step that took away the voting rights of people with intellectual disabilities. And Ms. Villanueva was stripped of this right when she went to get an appointment to get a national ID card. I suspect that many of you are very familiar with this story. The government official processing the ID would not speak to her, addressing only her mother, who accompanied her. Eventually, Ms. Villanueva's mother complained that her daughter was perfectly capable of answering the clerk's questions directly. "She votes," her mother told the clerk. "Not anymore," the clerk responded and initiated proceedings to have her struck from the voting rolls. All of this began an extraordinary campaign led by Ms. Villanueva and supported by the Open Society Foundations to help restore voting rights to thousands of Peruvians whose voting rights were denied because of their disability. Much of the campaign featured Ms. Villanueva speaking passionately for herself, for her own rights, embodying a reason to overturn Peru's discriminatory law. She addressed the UN, and Mr. Nair hosted her at an event in OSF. Eventually, the Peruvian government relented, issuing a new rule saying that all persons with disabilities not under guardianship would be reinstated in the voting registry. I tell this story for a few reasons. First, because it shows the incredible impact that even one person can have to stand up to injustice. That is the kind of work that we are so honored to support here at OSF. Second, it stood out as important, but a partial victory for people with disabilities in Peru and is setting precedent all around the world. At the time, Peru failed to unequivocally acknowledge that all persons with disabilities have the right to political participation, and it maintained a system in which people with disabilities' voices and choices are restricted or denied in many other ways. We are here today to tell the rest of the story, to listen to the rest of the story. We are here to understand why this story is so important, that it's not just about voting rights, it is about safeguarding the right to dignity for millions around the world. Ms. Villanueva's story about the restrictions people with disabilities face on the right to vote was not an outlier, as you all well know. People with intellectual and psychosocial disabilities rarely enjoy equal recognition under the law. For most people, this right is so familiar that we take it for granted. But for people with disabilities, it is often tossed aside by courts, doctors, bankers, and others. All over the world, once labeled with a disability, one can lose one's voice and power to control one's own life through guardianship or interdiction or other ways of sidelining by family, guardians, and other members of the community. In the United States, for example, 1.5 million people face some sort of restriction to their legal capacity. In Peru and Colombia, each tens of thousands, if not more, are restricted. Too often, these restrictions are based on a lack of faith in the judgment of people with disabilities and the desire to protect them from harm. Or, like the case of the Peruvian voting registry, society applies its own notion of what is in the best interest of people with disabilities, rather than remove what restricts people from disabilities for speaking or deciding for themselves. That is often the root of the problem. We call this the soft bigotry of low expectations. The result is people with disabilities can be barred from voting, getting married, being a witness, opening a bank account, signing a contract or a lease, appointing an attorney, organizing and registering as an organization, giving consent or refusing consent to medical treatment, and the list goes on. For some people with disabilities, decisions as basic as what to eat are made by others. This is wrong. Upholding legal capacity is not about kindness, it is not about support, it is about assuming for everyone that the basic dignity of agency and choice is not taking shortcuts to enabling everyone to access that. The individual decisions we make day to day and cumulatively over the course of our lives are a fundamental expression of who we are. Taking away a person's ability to make these choices is akin to taking away their voice and trying to take away their power. An open society does not wall off certain groups of people, saying that they do not have the capacity to make decisions about their own lives. An open society does not paint a portrait of the ideal decision maker against which all other people are judged. And that is why this is such a fundamental issue for the Open Society Foundations. And that is why, for the past 5 years, OSF has funded efforts in Colombia and Peru and 10 other countries to promote socio-legal reforms on legal capacity. And this is why I turn to other human rights and development donors to consider the area of legal capacity as a crucial aspect of rights and development. We all know that this is an underfunded and critically important space, so we do hope to see the sector come together in support. At the same time as we support efforts around the world, I would like for those of us from OSF to ask ourselves some tough questions. The pernicious biases that have led us to lead this struggle from behind are so ingrained into our societies. I think we need to ask ourselves honestly if they have bled in some ways into our work, as biases do. Are there ways that we act that overlook people with disabilities in effect, rendering them invisible to us? Where do we need to change our assumptions and modify how we operate so we can fully include everyone? Are we working in a way that fully recognizes and respects the agencies of all of the communities that we serve? These are the really wrestled challenge within philanthropy. Fundamentally, are we as individuals, members of our communities, and funders part of the change people with disabilities are seeking, are demanding from society? How do we keep ourselves from being the problem? From Brazil to Georgia to Zambia, governments are finding ways to allow people with disabilities to maintain more control over their lives and decisions. Systems and services are designed so that people wishing to access greater control of their lives can do so. At the end of 2018, Peru became the first country in the world to fully recognize the right of every person to exercise their legal capacity. Just 3 months ago, in August 2019, Colombia became the second country to do so. Both victories were led, this is so critically important, by people with disabilities, many of whom themselves had been declared incompetent under the law. We are lucky to be joined by three people who have helped win this tremendous victory and are in a position to tell us why it is so important and how we can better support their work. And then just on a personal note for me, it's a real honor to be here. My brother, my dear brother who I grew up with, has cerebral palsy, nonverbal, paraplegic, and many of these struggles are known deeply and inherently to our family as we attempted to support him in telling the world that he has a voice, even if his words are not the same as many of us understand. So it is a real honor for me to be here amongst you as well and all of you who support this work. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicole, and welcome everyone, and welcome to our panelists. And we will now just watch very short clips that will bring you into the world of Colombia and Peru. I'll just say a word about the first clip that we'll see. I remember the day when we got notice from our colleagues in Peru that the law had passed, and we could not believe it because we've been struggling with many countries around the world to create this change. And I think that what made us actually believe it was watching this short clip done shortly after the law was passed, very amateurishly, but really passes the message. And then we'll watch another short clip from Colombia, which we find interesting because it comes from the media. This is a news item and how they portrayed the victory in Colombia. And then I'll introduce myself and the panelists. So let's watch. Thank you very much. So a quick introduction. I'm Tirza Leibowitz from the Human Rights Initiative here at Open Society, and we have our panelists with us. So starting from the end, Pamela Smith, who is the director of SODIS, Claudia Zapata, who is a self-advocate and trained as a facilitator on supported decision-making, and we'll learn through this panel what that means. And we have Karin Lisa Gutierrez, self-advocate with Peruvian Down Syndrome Society, and we have Patricia Andrade, who's here as a support person for Karin. And so I'd like to begin with asking each of the panelists a question, and begin with you, Karin. Maybe just to say, we're going to be working across languages, styles of communication, and so we're going to make sure everyone has a chance to communicate the way they feel comfortable. And so, Karin, the question to you is if you can tell us your story. When did you learn that you don't have legal capacity? What did that mean for you? And what did you do about it?
Buenas noches con todos, con todas. Yo mismo, Karin, Nilce Gutierrez. Tengo.
My name is Karin.
Tengo 35 años.
I'm 35 years old.
Y vengo. Contarles mi nombre es Karin Lisa Gutiérrez y tengo 35 años.
My name is Karin Lisa Gutiérrez.
Nací en Lima de Perú. Gracias por invitarme para contar mi historia.
Thank you for inviting me to tell my story.
Mi mamá me internetó para cobrar la pensión. De mi papá.
My mother banned me from collecting my father's pension.
Fuimos al banco al momento de pagarme, no me llamaron a mí. Le dijeron a mi mamá que ella firme y dieron la plata.
We went to the bank, and when they were supposed to pay me, they didn't call me. They told my mother that she should sign, and they gave her the money.
No me tomaron la cuenta.
They didn't take me into account.
Fui varias veces al banco y siempre lo mismo. Hasta que dejé ir porque me di cuenta y que iba por gusto.
I went several times to the bank and it was always the same until I quit going because I realized that there was no use in going.
Mi mamá tampoco ella entendía. Cuando yo llegué en la sociedad peruana del Señor de Medao, aprendí a conocer mis derechos. Supe que algunas personas estaban interditas, pero eso no podía tomar sus decisiones.
And neither my mother understood. When I arrived at the Down Syndrome Peruvian Society, I learned about my rights. I knew that some people are banned and that is why they cannot make their own decisions.
En este momento, yo ya sabía que yo también estaba interdita.
At that moment, I didn't know that I was also banned.
Como cuando comencé a trabajar, fui la segunda vez que estaba tratando diferente, como si yo fuera como una niña.
When I started to work, that was the second time that they were treating me differently, as if I was a little girl.
A mí me dieron mi contrato para trabajar y yo lo firmé, pero a mí me dijeron que me tenía que llamar a mi mamá para que firme porque mi firma no contaba.
They gave me my contract so that I could start working, and I signed it, but they told me I had to call my mother for her to sign because my signature was not valid.
Yo le dije de ir a mi mamá porque tú tenías que firmar. Sí, la que trabajaba soy yo.
I told my mother, why do you have to sign if I'm the one who's working?
Otra vez tuve que volver a firmar contrato. Y siempre pasaba lo mismo.
Other times I had to sign contracts, and every time the same thing happened.
Ella me explicó, eso pasaba porque estaba interdita y no me gustó y yo quería firmar sola.
She explained to me that happened because I was banned. I didn't like it. I wanted to sign on my own, by myself.
Ahí me di cuenta que yo no quería estar interdita. Esos 7 años que trabajo y pago las cuentas. Pero a mí, mamá tenía que firmar. Y para sacar mi tarjeta de banco y cobrar mi sueldo para comprar mis cosas.
There, I realized that I did not want to be banned. 7 years ago, it's been since I work, I pay my own bills, but my mother has to sign so that I can get my bank card, collect my salary, and buy my things.
Hasta mi celular está con su nombre. Me sentía mal siempre, mi mamá. Me sentí discriminada ahí recién que supe que yo estaba interdita y yo no quería.
Even my cell phone had her name. I didn't feel well. It didn't feel right. It was always my mom. I felt discriminated against. That's when I learned that I was banned and I didn't want to.
La tercera vez fui cuando no me dejaron votar. tenía que ir a votar y me dijeron que yo no podía votar porque no estaba en la lista. Otra vez me sentí discriminada y me fui al baño a llorar rabia.
The third time was when I was not allowed to vote. I had to go vote and they told me that I could not vote because I was not on the list. Once again, I felt discriminated against and I went to the bathroom to cry. I was enraged.
Karin, we would like to hear from you what you did with this, with this situation. But I do want to stop for a second because something may have got lost in translation. People may be asking, how is it that Karin, you became banned? Like, how did that actually happen? And I just wanted to fill in the term interdiction that we keep on referring to. It's a situation where someone can go on behalf of a person to the court and to ask for an order that legally puts that person aside and appoints someone else to make decisions in their place. So that's folded into the word interdiction that appears here in the translation. And I just want to add one thing in conversation with Karin before this event. What happened here was, and I'm saying this because it connects to the point that Nicole, you made beforehand. Sometimes the motivation is the protective one, right? In this case, the authorities apparently asked, and Karin, tell me if that was the case, they suggested to the family, why don't you go ahead and sign these papers? It will be easier for Karin to receive the pension that she's entitled to. And Nicole, when you were recounting what happened in Peru around the voting rights, this was the government saying voting in Peru is mandatory. Why have people with disabilities go through the hassle of it? Let's strike them off, right? So that motivation of protection, which we're saying this is a very, very political, this protective space. So, Karin, let's hear, what did you do after crying? Because we know you became active on this. Please tell us what you did with this.
Yo estaba pidiendo, me fui a reclamar me fui a reclamar a juez para que me quite la internación.
I went with a judge and protested. I asked the judge to remove the interdiction.
Can I ask a question, Karin, about this? I know that the law had to be changed in Peru, and I wanted to ask if you participated in the work to change the law in Peru.
Yo estaba hablando con congresistas para que me quite la internación.
I was in conversation with the Congress people so that they would eliminate this interdiction.
Mm-hmm. And just out of curiosity, you are a colleague and a friend of Maria Alejandra, was that something that you did together with other self-advocates?
Sí.
Yes.
Yo fui con una amiga, Sandra Celis.
And I'm also a friend of Sandra Celis.
Sandra Celis, sí, es una persona autogestora.
Sandra Celis is also a person that is a self-advocate.
I think think our translator learned a new word for this event, self-advocate, a very important word. And maybe just the last question, Karin, for this round. You approached the judge after the law was changed. If you can just tell us how you felt, or what, first of all, what did the judge decide and how you felt?
A mí, a unos abogados me ayudado a hacer una carta para llevarle al juez.
I was given some letters by an attorney to bring to the judge.
Para que me quitara la internación. Que ese es la internación, ese difícil, porque nosotros, si nos moquemos, pero así no aprendimos.
To remove the interdiction, but it's something very hard, but this is how we learned.
Y este momento yo me di cuenta. A mí que no me dejaba no me dejaba votar, firmar a mi contrato de trabajo.
I noticed that this would impede me from voting or to sign the contract at work.
Me sentí mal por esta legislación.
I didn't like this legislation.
I just want to add that Karin sent us the notice of the revoking of the interdiction, and I have to say that I had mixed feelings. On the one hand, participating in Karin's sense of liberation, and on the other hand, you know, the bittersweet feeling that people actually have to fight for this very, very basic right.
Yo sí me sentí que el juez me quitó la internación y sentí liberadamente.
I felt liberated by the fact that the judge removed the interdiction.
And I guess I borrowed, having conversations with Karin, I borrowed the word liberation from your story. Thank you, Karin. We'll move on to Claudia. We threw out the word supported decision-making. If you can say a word about what that is, and then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
Bueno, primero, muchas gracias por invitarnos y muchas gracias por venir a escucharnos.
Well, thank you for inviting us and thank you for listening to us.
Antes de hablar del proceso de pilotos de la toma de decisiones con apoyos, quiero contarles que yo me considero una persona en situación de discapacidad, ya que hace 20 años fui diagnosticada con trastorno afectivo bipolar. Y gracias al proyecto pude.
I would like to thank you, and I will speak more about this pilot for the decision taking and for the supports. And speak that not too long ago, I found out that I was also disabled because I was diagnosed with bipolar syndrome.
Y gracias al proyecto, entonces me vinculé como facilitadora, estuve en el curso y acompañé a alguien de mi asociación a hacerle el sistema de apoyos.
Thank you for thanks to this project, I was able to become a facilitator.
Entonces recibí la capacitación para ser facilitadora y a una persona de mi organización, un joven de 30 años, me acompañé.
The training to become a facilitator for this person who's 35 years from my organization, who's 35 years old, de 35 años.
Sí. Entonces, la toma de decisiones con apoyos es una serie de herramientas para acompañar, para explicar, para que la persona que está en condición de discapacidad entienda la situación.
So this is like the support for decision making is a kind of tool to help people kind of exercise their legal capacity so they could make their own decisions.
Ofrecerles todas las opciones y que la persona con sus necesidades, con sus preferencias y con sus expectativas tome la decisión que ella considere.
To explain to them other options so that the person can make their own decision after being informed.
And just a follow-up question, something that we discussed before, and Nicole, you also mentioned it. Is this a kind, I could see people thinking, okay, this is help. This is help, this is kindness, this is compassion. How would you describe, is that the essence of the support decision-making or upholding legal capacity? Or how would you describe the essence to someone who doesn't know what it is? Like, what is this issue?
Resulta que todas las personas somos seres humanos y como seres humanos tenemos una dignidad.
It turns out we're all human beings, and as human beings, we have dignity. We want dignity.
Valores y capacidad jurídica.
Values and legal capacity.
Eso es dado por los derechos humanos, pues por la convención.
And this is through, it's mentioned in the Convention of Human Rights.
Pero cuando la persona, como en mi caso, está diagnosticada y es considerada en condición de discapacidad,
when someone like myself is diagnosed and is considered to be someone disabled,
automáticamente para la persona, para su familia y para la comunidad pierde toda posibilidad
jurídica. Automatically, as a person, for the community and to their family, you lose all legal capacity.
Entonces, con esta nueva ley pues, que estamos aplicando en Colombia, esa capacidad jurídica se restablece.
And with this new law that has been approved in Colombia, we are reestablishing that legal capacity.
Y todas las personas en condición de discapacidad podemos tomar decisiones de bancarias.
And everybody who is considered disabled can now make decisions about their bank accounts.
De proyecto de vida, médicas, todo a nivel legal.
All legal levels, medical or any project in life.
Thank you, Claudia. We may get back and maybe dig a bit further because it's huge progress, but there are also challenges, so we'll get to that further. Pamela, bring us into the political space. So this happened in Peru, it happened in Colombia. There are many other countries around the world who are working on this, but they have not succeeded in reaching this level of legislation. What made it work in, I'm going to say it here in this room, in Peru and Colombia of all places?
Hi, everyone. I'm very honored to be here sharing with the self-advocates. If I have to think about what was the process that led to this piece of legislation. Unfortunately, it wasn't an act of justice coming from government. It was an entire and articulated strategy we have to put in place in order to obtain this piece of legislation. First of all, we assess the political and legal situation of our countries. We were aware that the CRPD and the paradigm shift brought by the CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, was quite challenging, and the Article 12 was one of the most contested articles in the process of adoption. So we have to think about a strategy that addresses all the challenge that we would found on the way. So, first of all, we went through this analysis. We tried to engage people into the conversation, and actually, one of the first steps was right after the Peru ratified the convention. So when the new Disability Act was being negotiated, we kind of laid the ground and laid the foundations for this new legal reform, the reform on legal capacity, back in 2012. So it's been years of work, We've been identifying allies during all this process. So a commission was formed at the Congress level. We also were aware that we need to like tackle the system and untangle the system at very different levels, not only legally, but also practically. So that's why we went through, we went for the law. We tried to like to set out the paradigm shift into this new bill regarding legal capacity. And in that particular space, like we engage congressmen, politicians, public officers, so they were now aware of what it meant to for someone to what the removal of legal capacity meant for persons with disabilities. So we proved that the system didn't work, that legal capacity, that interdiction and guardianship didn't protect anyone, even though it was like created or it was supposed to protect people. So we work on legislation, we engage allies in this process at very different levels, and we try to move from legal and the policy side also to practice. So we are now introducing this new concept of supports rather than legal representatives. So what do supports mean? We work then on projects, on pilot projects regarding supports for decision making, a focus on persons with intellectual and psychosocial disabilities. Raising awareness was quite important, and that's why the self-advocates were speaking up, sharing their stories of how a life without legal capacity looks like. So in that sense, more people understood this issue, the importance of this issue at the very core of human rights. Many of us didn't struggle with that, so it was quite important for the self-advocates and the disability rights movement to speak up, to share their stories, and to be involved in this entire process.
Thank you very much. I just want to complete the picture. I know that we have a couple of people from the US working on legal capacity. So we're hearing from Latin America. We're sitting here in New York City in the United States. And it would be interesting to hear, where is Kathy here? Kathy Costanzo, can you just say a word? I was going up the elevator today with the director of Open Society US, and I mentioned the event, and he said, oh, the US is doing well on this, right? What would you say to him? Hello, Tony.
Hi, I run an organization. We've had the experience of doing 7 pilots, 6 of them in Massachusetts, 1 in Georgia. We're working with a group of people in Georgia. As you all probably know, the United States did not ratify the UN Convention. Article 12 was a big factor. Why? Because there were very conservative parent groups who were, you know, very well organized, very well financed, who absolutely fought it. And as a result, the Article 12, it would recognize the rights of all individuals to have legal capacity, and that was something that they just could not tolerate because they thought that it would challenge their ability to continue as guardians for their own children. So we've had, I would say that in our pilots, we've had a lot of really positive, wonderful things happening. Not surprisingly, when someone is no longer under guardianship and their full personhood is allowed to emerge, great things happen and people really are full participants in their own lives and they feel very empowered and rightfully so. So, we've really seen this metamorphosis of a number of the people that we've worked with. In the United States, there are 8 states in the District of Columbia that have legislation now where a law has been passed around supported decision making that recognizes it in the law. That's a good thing. those laws are more or less good. And you know, where the rubber really hits the road is, are they going to be implemented, and what is it going to look like? And is it going to, you know, just be like a fancy new version of guardianship dressed up to look a little differently? So those are all the things that we really see as challenges here. One of the things we've done is, you know, we see that there's this huge issue of trying to roll out the idea of supported decision making across the entire country, or even the entire state of Massachusetts, which is not even that big. And that, you know, there's a limited utility of just doing pilots. We've worked very closely with self-advocates, with families. We now have the government very interested, the government agencies, in working with us to think about how to expand the idea of supported decision making. But we've put a lot of our resources recently into developing a training and technical assistance center. And to we have a great website dedicated to supported decision making. Welcome you all to look at it and get feedback from you about it. But it talks a lot about the successes, what we've learned, what we need to learn, and the challenges ahead. I think just one last thing to note, I think the political context of the U.S., like probably every country, has to be taken into consideration. And right now it's pretty ugly here. And the realities are, you know, that there's backlash against people with disabilities because we don't want to do anything about gun control, so it's easier to blame people who have psychiatric labels attached to their names and to their lives. And so, you know, I think those are the kinds of things that are now resulting in, you know, this move toward institutionalizing people more. And I'm sure if that's the case, it will be stripping them of rights in other ways. So that's probably enough.
Thanks, Kathy. I just want to thank you. I know that we have some colleagues listening to the to this event. We heard Latin America, we heard United States, just to say, and also for some of you who are working in other countries from Open Society, in some places, guardianship may not be the issue so much, although guardianship provisions exist almost all over the world. But in many places, it's the way communities are arranged. Sometimes it's informal arrangements. Sometimes it's just the ability to go to court and sideline a person with disability. And we have a colleague from OSISA, from Open Society Initiative in Southern Africa, who is leading some work in that region around this category of unsound mind that exists in many countries, under which people then cannot run for office and many other things. So this notion that a label brings about some form of taking away very, very basic rights is something that we're seeing around the world, and it may take different names or different forms in different countries, but it's something that we're trying to understand in each context. What's the root there, and advocates are trying to address. I want to open up just for questions from the audience. And I see already hands raised. I just want to say we'll collect a couple of questions. And I also invite colleagues that don't work on disability necessarily, either within Open Society or outside, but are in the business of human rights. If you have any reflections, if this, what you've heard and what you've learned, does it connect in any way to your work? Does it, you know, resonate in any way? Do you find it useful in any way for how you're thinking about your field of work? It would be great to hear that as well. So let's collect a few questions. Is that Tony back there? Yes. Hi, Tony.
I have a question. What is the difference between me and a worker? Everybody here wear glasses. What is the difference? Is it that y'all is looking at the wheelchair and not at the person? Because really, I should have the same right that everybody else, no matter what. Okay, I'm gonna talk about making decision making. Number one, I'm working on that. Number two, I am fighting against it being an agency money-making making positive for the agency. But I'm saying, I don't want it to be you at a goal.
So, Tony, can I? I think I know what you're referring to, or I can say the concern that you're voicing is something that we also struggle with. If I understand you correctly, you're pointing at the risk of supported decision-making projects to become a money-making mechanism. If I understand correctly, if I may add, something that may be artificial, not reflect how people actually make decisions or be a way to do other things. Is that what you're referring to?
Everything that we do is money making. Even if we go to the bathroom, people make money off of us. I think it's ridiculous. If we ask human beings, they say, why do you use us to make money? Why can't we get a regular job like you? Why can't we get paid like you? When we go to the store, we don't get nothing free. Anger, do you have money? Come on.
So, Tony, I want to keep your question in this room. I want it to hover. I want to see if people may want to address. If not, I can share some of our dilemmas around what you're raising. So let's collect one or two other questions and then get back to that.
Good afternoon. I'm from the UN Partnership on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. The partnership basically supports UN country teams at the field level to implement the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And of the 39 countries that we're currently supporting projects in, there's currently work going on in Serbia and previously in Moldova around legal capacity. So I just wanted to share a little because you asked earlier about what's happening elsewhere, but also really ask and learn from colleagues in Latin America what their experience was, which hopefully we might be able to take back and share with our colleagues in the field. So in Moldova, actually the work was very closely interlinked with the process of deinstitutionalization, which was basically moving people and giving them the right to live in the community with their families like other persons in their family. And because of all of the abuses, the human rights violations that were happening in institutions, and because people in institutions did not really have the right or the legal capacity, they were not really able to go to court or to make complaints. So the processes were quite parallel. The advocacy that led to the deinstitutionalization was also the advocacy that ensured that legal capacity began to be recognized. As a result, of course, there was an independent monetary mechanism to, you know, oversee the violations that were taking place, and people could go to court following the legal capacity reforms that happened. We were not able to go all the way, and this was from about a year and a half ago, which is when we have the last reports from, but they did reform the civil code, and each and every case of guardianship had to be reviewed and allowed by the courts. So it did open up the whole process for appeal. But what we saw was, as a result of this, it wasn't just about legal capacity in a court, but about participation. So people went to court if they were not allowed admission in their neighborhood school and received damage and received decisions that helped them to participate in other areas of life. We're currently also supporting work in Serbia that's looking to revise the family law, which is the broader law that governs legal capacity issues in the country. And my question was related.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, and my question was related to colleagues who spoke earlier. And what we're finding is, of course, parallel to the whole legal process that the UN is supporting other partners to work on, is how do you build a robust movement of self-advocates? Because we're talking about societies that have traditionally not had any participation or any legal capacity, where parents' groups are still very strong. So how did you, what was the factor that enabled success in that regard?
Okay, let's take one more question. Please, Amar.
I am Amar. I work at Open Society US. Just want to say, in terms of, you know, you'd asked Tirza how what we heard here might resonate with work for folks who don't necessarily work on disability rights. I just wanted to share that when I was an advocate, an organization I worked with for created an app, a phone app, to allow members of the Sikh community, the faith community from which I belong to file complaints that were accepted as official complaints by the Department of Homeland Security if they were accusing the Department of profiling. And what we found when the app was released, in addition to the Sikh community, the two populations that were using the app the most and filing the most complaints that the Department of Homeland Security then had to respond to officially were, one, women complaining of gender discrimination, and then second was folks with disabilities. And then when we released the second version of the app, we worked with advocates who focus on those both those communities to adjust the questions the app would ask to take into account the rights of women and the rights of folks with disabilities. And that's just my way of saying that as we sort of this week at OSF think through our commitment to disability rights and inclusion, you know, it would behoove all of us to make sure as we do all our rights work that we bring everyone along. It was a real learning experience for me just creating the app to see that we hadn't accounted for the rights of everyone we could have accounted for and putting that out into the world. So thank you for this forum, and it's been a real great learning experience.
Thank you. So Chris will hear you, and then I'm going to appoint just a couple of people to give short answers, and we'll wrap up. So Chris, please.
Since you mentioned New York, this is by way of information. We have a very robust pilot project in New York. I think it's to date the largest project in the country. We've enrolled over 100 people in the last 3.5 years. We are moving towards beginning to plan for legislation and also hoping that New York State will adopt this system that we've developed for facilitating and enabling people to use support to make their own decisions in their own lives, both to get out from under guardianship, but also to persuade parents and others who might be seeking guardianship for transition age youth. So if people are interested in what's going on in New York, we are SDMNY, Supported Decision Making New York. We have a website. But what I also want to say is that when we started this 5 years ago and began to try to think about what kind of a facilitation model we wanted to use, we were emboldened and enlightened and supported by the projects that OSF supports around the world, particularly the folks in Bulgaria, in Kenya, and in the Czech Republic. And we have learned so much in the international communications and support and sharing of experiences has really been incredible. And we are so excited and thrilled by Peru and by Colombia. Every time I go to an information session with parents or others now, and especially with the young people who we call decision makers, the people with intellectual disabilities, knowing that they are part of a worldwide movement is an incredibly important thing for them as well. So I wanted to thank you for that and let people know that we're here in New York and you want to talk to us and help us. That'd be great.
Thank you. And I want to put actually Luhan on the spot to address some of the tougher issues here that we heard in the room. There is an inherent tension between defining a system of support in decision making, right? When we make decisions in our lives, we just do it. We go and we ask people for it. We all actually get support in decision making, but we just do it. And it's not written in law and it doesn't have procedures. So that's on the one hand. And now we're trying to mimic that and to just enable equal rights for everyone. And it, yes, there is a tension there because suddenly it's kind of quantified in law. And I'll just want to point out that in Peru and in Colombia, contrary to the United States is not there yet. There is progress, but the United States has not eliminated taking away legal capacity, which Peru and Colombia have pretty much eliminated, but they went as far as kind of saying, if you want support, you ask for it, right? Now, some people feel, at least their advocates, feel left out. What if I don't know how to ask for supports? So we have a tension between full rights and how does that look, and not leaving anyone behind. And I just want to ask Wuhan if you have any thought about that, the tension that Tony brought up.
Yes, I think it's broader than what Tony mentioned. Obviously, I think that there's a real danger of creating the supported decision-making model to be believed as that's the only way that we can guarantee people legal capacity. And that becomes a threshold for anybody to have legal capacity. You have to have support. And I think that's a real challenge for a lot of people. And, you know, for a lot of the decision-making that we're doing in life, sometimes we need support, sometimes we don't need support. Sometimes, you know, support is welcome, sometimes it's part of the paternalistic environment that's confining people. So I think, you know, there's a real tension there in terms of promoting supported decision-making, how we explain what it is and how we say that that's only one framework that we can use to look at decision making, and there's a broader concept of decision making. And I think there's also, I mean, I work in Asia around the subject of legal capacity, and there I think a lot of the emphasis is on perhaps developing more tools. If we have advanced directive written into our laws, perhaps we can make use of that. Of course, I think that's all very helpful. But I think it's also important for the disability movement to be able to come up with a narrative and to talk about decision making and talk about legal capacity beyond these tools, beyond the technical interventions, and to say what exactly it is and how can these technical advancements help. And sometimes maybe they provide further limitations if we don't change the overall atmosphere.
Thanks. I'm reminded by Claudia, what you said about there's something about being human and the dignity that comes with it, period, right? That's it.
Same.
I just want to end just with a one question about, which I think is an important one for all of us, about self-advocacy, whoever asked here, about how do you do more of that? So I don't know if there's one short intervention that one of you, I see, on self-advocacy specifically. What does it take to get more of that? Juliana, do you want? Very short.
Hello. Yep. Okay. So
hello. Maybe this? Hello. Well, hello, I'm Juliana Bustamante from País in Colombia, and I just want to mention a quick thought about self-advocacy. What we find is that having organizations empowering people with disabilities, like in Colombia WASAS Down and Pro Familia on legal and sexual and reproductive rights, as long as these organizations, and our experience is that seeing these organizations talking to persons, to people with disability, teach them how their what means to have legal capacity, and teach them how to be empowered and how they can become agents of change and of decision making, they become multipliers of the message. So I think it's a lot of work from the base, social base, from organizations that have been, and that's the same case in Peru, being able to come together with the people with disability, talking directly to them and turning them into facilitators, like Claudia, and into multipliers of the message of legal capacity, empowerment, and human rights for people with disability. That's
anything. I'm going to actually, we'll end by this. I'm going to put you, Patricia, on the spot. That's okay? because you're now supporting Karim in this panel, but you also work with families. And if you can say one thing that is difficult for families to do that you work with them to do, around family members to take more autonomy, just maybe the biggest challenge.
Uh-huh. Bueno, creo que lo que hemos hecho es que otras familias, como la madre de Karim, que está muy convencida que su hija puede tomar decisiones y que no necesitaba que otra persona la tome por ella.
What we have done is like with Karina's mother, we have taught her that yes, that Karina can make her own decisions, that she doesn't need someone else to make decisions for her.
Porque muchas veces las familias le dicen al profesional, es que tú no sabes cómo es tener temor que los hijos cometan errores, etc. Entonces, cuando lo escuchan de otro familiar, lo...
Sometimes when families speak with professionals, they let them know you really don't know how it is to have this fear of the person you're guarding for them to make their decisions or not being able to.
Sí, así que parte de la estrategia siempre ha sido que las familias abren con las familias, los jueces con los jueces, los notarios con los notarios, porque se escucha mejor el mensaje.
The strategy has always been family speaking with families, judges speaking with judges, attorneys speaking to attorneys, so that everyone's more aware of this topic.
Thank you. So I think we're going to wrap up just to leave you with the complexity of the issue. One thing that we're also struggling with around the question of, let's say, self-advocates, we often speak about us empowering self-advocates, and I think the real power will be when we don't do it for self-advocates. It's they, you know, people do what they do, which is speak up for their rights. I want to thank all of you, and especially those of you who came with a story that was your individual story, and you turned it into an issue that is relevant to many people. So thank you for joining us, and thank you for everyone. I want to just end with a poem by Kavafi, the Egyptian Greek poet from this century, from the 20th century. Walls, without consideration, without pity, without shame, they have built great and high walls around me. And now I sit here and despair. I think of nothing else. This fate gnaws at my mind. For I had many things to do outside. Ah, why did I not pay attention when they were building the walls? But I never heard any noise or sound of builders. Imperceptibly, they shut me from the outside world. It sounds pessimistic, but walls are built, they're not inherent, they're built, and we can take them apart. Thank you.